Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America here on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for August 27th, 2023. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, and this is the AEW All In After Show after the event at Wembley Stadium that, according to AEW, drew over 81,000 paid to set a new pro wrestling paid attendance record. So obviously that is one of the big stories coming out of All In. You can expect your social media timelines to be filled in with people agreeing, disagreeing, arguing about that number for years to come, as we've become accustomed. This was a very good show, even if there were things that you didn't like. I think overall the show as a whole was a hit. So I want to hear your thoughts. 515-605-9345 is the number. Press 1 to show up in the queue to talk. Otherwise, you can hang out and listen. You can also email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com is where you're going to want to go to send an email. We'd love to hear from you via email as well. I hope you'll join us. I'm just tweeting out a reminder. We're on the air live right now, so people know to tune in. And we are here each and every week, by the way. Usually 8 p.m. Eastern. Next weekend's going to be a little funky because we've got two pay-per-views all out on Sunday and Payback, WWE's offering on Saturday. My plan right now is to do two shows, one Saturday after Payback, one Sunday after All Out. Stay tuned for details. If anything changes, I'll tweet it out at Greg M. Parks. But the show today was very good, lived up to, I think, what people were expecting out of a major stadium show of this level from AEW. The pre-show, first pre-show match, there were two pre-show matches. First pre-show match, as had been advertised, was MJF and Adam Cole defeating Aussie Open to win the ROH tag titles. Really wasn't any tease of a dissension. I was wrong on this one. I thought that the ROH titles were kind of a red herring. What was a red herring was that they were a red herring. So it was kind of like a double red herring here, as MJF and Adam Cole won and went into the show. So, I mean, so here's the thing. If you are on the fence about watching the show, about buying the show, spending $50 on All In, and you're watching the pre-show, what is more interesting to get you to cross over and buy it? Is it teasing dissension of these best friends who you're kind of anticipating coming to blows at some point and thinking it might come in the main event? Or is it having them win the titles, having them stay together as friends, and then thinking, okay, they didn't do it there. That means there must be a big tease of something in the main event, and I'm going to tune in for that. Because I think as much as a lot of people, and you're hearing it from the live crowds, are enjoying the idea of MJF and Adam Cole being partners and enjoying the ride of this unique friendship that we're seeing with these two, I do think at some point there's the anticipation of it's going to be really fun when they eventually one turns on the other. And that's the big mystery too. We didn't really know who was going to turn on who. We got hints of it later on. But as far as the pre-show match, nothing real in that one. MJF and Cole get the victory. But now this is just another added layer to the friendship, another added layer to the story that they're telling with Adam Cole and MJF as friends. The second pre-show match was Hook winning the FTW title over Jack Perry. Some controversy in this match. The story had gotten out a few weeks ago that Jack Perry wanted to use real glass on an episode of Collision. CM Punk, who is the Collision sheriff, I guess, basically told Perry, hey, we don't do that here. And so Perry made a comment during his match about using real glass, And then there was a confrontation, a quote-unquote physical confrontation, reported by Fightful after the show, because Punk was in Gorilla, because he was the first match on the show. So there was a confrontation. I haven't read both sides yet, so I don't want to say what for sure happened, other than there was a confrontation between Punk and Jack Perry. So now we have that hanging over this. I don't think it was the main talking point coming out of this show, but certainly has to be one of the talking points coming out of this show, again, on a very successful weekend for AEW, where they were able to put a lot of the negativity that had been building up behind them. This Punk situation, and I'm not saying it's his fault, because I don't know for sure the details yet, but the Punk situation rears its ugly head again. The first match on All In proper was CM Punk defeating Samoa Joe with the Pepsi Plunge. So that was this was for the Real World Championship. Punk retained that. I think we all expect at some point it to come to a head with CM Punk and with whoever the champion is at that time. You know, probably going to be MJF, one would think, but you don't know for sure. But it's hard to see him losing the quote-unquote Real World Championship before then. This is a good match. I thought this was a good match to start the show off with. He started hot with someone on the level of CM Punk, as opposed to being buried somewhere else on this four-hour show. So I thought it was smart to get him out there first. We had the second match being a six-man tag with Konosuke Takeshita, Jay White, and Juice Robinson defeating Kenny Omega, Kota Ibushi, and Adam Page. Takeshita rolls up Kenny Omega and gets the victory, so he pins Kenny Omega. This was a match that certainly felt like it was building Takeshita versus Kenny Omega for All Out next weekend. It's going to be a lot of matches having to be announced this week on AEW television. Luckily, they have three TV shows this week to do it in, but really solid six-man match. It did feel a little bit more like, and I would use the word exhibition, in that it didn't really feel like the result mattered all that much, only to get from point A to point B, being getting, you know, from this match to Takeshita versus Kenny Omega next weekend. It felt like the stakes were not there that you would like in a match of this magnitude with stars the size of, you know, Jay White and Kenny Omega and Kota Ibushi being used in probably one of his few, you know, maybe AEW marquee matches. You would like it to be a little higher stakes, probably would like it to be singles matches with involving some of these competitors, but that'll be saved. And that's the trouble with having another pay-per-view right after it so close, is that, you know, you've got to save some of those key singles matches for that show. And it looks like they're going to do it again, because at the very end of the show, they announced All In at Wembley again next year on August 25th. So I don't know if this is going to be a yearly thing, but we know that Tony Khan likes his yearly traditions, and two in a row, we'll see how they draw next year. And certainly if they draw anywhere close to this, they're going to be making this a yearly trip over to England for that. By the way, I don't really know where is a good point to say this, but Mercedes Moné was shown in the crowd a number of times during the show, including the pre-show. So they did acknowledge her. You have to imagine that she's going to play a role in AEW at some point down the line. Match number three of the main card was FTR defeating the Young Bucks to retain the tag titles. Really good match. You know, the thing I'll say about these two tag teams, and I know that the Young Bucks get a reputation for not telling stories in their match, and their matches are all about spots and things like that. I disagree, and obviously FTR knows how to tell a tag team story. They've been doing it for years, dating back to the time in NXT. And the Young Bucks are a little older, a little slower. Even FTR, you know, they had a very physical last year in professional wrestling, where they had to defend all these different titles across different countries, and you know, they were, it took a toll, I'm sure, physically on their bodies. So this isn't NXT level FTR. This isn't you know, early or ROH Young Bucks or anything like that. But They still told a very good story. They still had enough of the athleticism left, especially the Young Bucks, where you don't feel like you were cheated out of a Young Bucks match or anything like that. But it was, you know, a half step or a step slower than what we're used to seeing of these teams. But, you know, that's just nature taking its course. But it was still really good. Match number four was the Stadium Stampede match. Orange Cassidy, Eddie Kingston, Penta, and the Best Friends defeating the BCC, Santana and Ortiz. Mike Santana, by the way, they really hit that new first name hard in this match. Cassidy pinned Claudio Castagnoli with a fist of... So I thought what made the most sense coming out of this would be to have Orange Cassidy lose the international title. The whole story that's been built up with him and the international title has been he's defending it almost every week on television, and it's catching up with him. It's taking its toll on him physically, and you know, you think that at some point he's going to lose that title when all that wear and tear just gets to him. And so I would say at All Out would be a good opportunity for him to lose the title, coming off a match where he was bloodied in this contest, where he was, you know, had glass involved. So I think if he's going to lose the title as a conclusion of the story that they're telling with him, then it should come at probably All Out. A quick turnaround for him, just a week. Obviously, not enough time to recover from the punishment that this match would take. So I think that would be pretty good. The Stadium Stampede was not the traditional Stadium Stampede that we've come to know, where a lot of it takes place backstage, where it's sometimes a little more cinematic. This was more of an Anarchy in the Arena match. It was physical. I think a match of this style, for it to be successful to the larger audience, it has to be wild. And people have to be able to say, wow, that was a wild match. And I think it was. I think it fit that, and I think people were largely satisfied with this, even if there were a lot of people who thought that maybe it was a little too violent at times and they did a little too much in that direction. No, I think it was a suitably violent, suitably wild for what we've become accustomed to for the Stadium Stampede style matches. Match number five was the women's match, the four-way Saraya defeating Hikaru Shida, Toni Storm, and Britt Baker to win the AEW Women's Championship. Saraya kept coming out to Queen. She came out with her family, and she beat Toni Storm, her fellow outcast, to win the title. A very emotional scene after the match with her and her family winning the title in England. And what this says for the future of the Outcast, Ruby Soho was out there as well, we don't know. But this was, I thought, on the higher end of even women's matches lately. I think I've been down on some of the key AEW women's matches that have been had on television and on pay-per-view of late. I thought this exceeded those matches that we've become accustomed to in AEW. Match number six was Sting and Darby Allin defeating Swerve Strickland and Christian Cage in a coffin match. This went a little longer than I thought it needed to, and there were not a lot of matches on this card that I thought too long. You know, sometimes that's a problem with AEW, where they have too many matches that go too far, and they don't appreciate the 8 to 10 minute matches the way you kind of wish they would as a viewer watching at home, especially once the show hits the 4-hour mark. But I thought this went a little long. You know, in matches like this, and this was violent, you know, Darby Allin did some things that you just cringe at, of course. But in a match like this with Sting being involved, I know that there was some rumors swirling months ago that he could potentially retire at Wembley Stadium at All In. And he didn't do that, but you do kind of appreciate Sting getting this opportunity at this point of his career to wrestle in front of 80,000 fans in a stadium show. So as much as this match was not really about Sting, in another way, it kind of was about Sting, at least from my point of view. You know, he was a guy that I was watching everything he did in this match, just trying to put myself in his shoes in the career that he's had in the many different places from all the eras of WCW and NWA before that to, being in Impact Wrestling and the eras that he went through in TNA, and then his short stint in WWE, and then coming to AEW for the twilight of his career, just imagining being through all of that, and then in the last year or so of your career, getting to have a moment like this. I mean, that was kind of what was on my mind more than anything else watching this match, even though the story with Christian's involvement, with Darby Allin and Swerve and their situation with Nick Wayne getting involved, that was the real story of the match. But to me, it was Sting and having this kind of match in front of this audience at this point in his career. The seventh match was Will Ospreay defeating Chris Jericho. This could have gone a couple different ways. You could have had Jericho trying to keep up with Will Ospreay. You could have had Ospreay slowing things down for Jericho. You could have had them trying to mix it up a little bit. I thought it was really well done. Ospreay looked like Will Ospreay. I mean, he just looked, even with Chris Jericho in there, who's still a pretty good performer more often than not at this stage of his career, Ospreay just looked like he was in a different planet physically and just everything, just talent-wise. You know, Jericho is a huge talent in his own right, but Father Time catching up with him, I think, within the last 6 months or a year especially. So this was a match that I think was it was going to be tough for Jericho, I think. It was to keep up and to make it the kind of match that people want to see out of Will Ospreay at this point of his career. I thought Jericho kept up well. I thought it was a good match. I really enjoyed the match. And, yeah, I think that was sort of the best I can say about it. And that's not – I don't mean to make that sound like an insult, but – you know, you do wonder, Will Ospreay has made it a point to say that he's going to be a free agent in New Japan coming up at some point soon. And so the win here is interesting. You know, there's going to be people read into that to say, well, he's AEW bound. I'm not so sure about that, but does make you wonder. It does make you wonder, especially if AEW gets the big rights fee increase, that they're going to have some money to throw around for free agents like Will Ospreay. And, you know, having All In at Wembley next year, you know, if you have Will Ospreay on your roster as a full-time member, that's going to be able to, if you're AEW, put him in a more prominent match on this show than just sort of an undercard match with Chris Jericho. I mean, you could be talking title match. You could be talking main event even. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility next year. We have the Acclaimed and Billy Gunn defeating the House of Black in an Anything Goes match to win the Trios title. So making a big to-do about the return of Billy Gunn after he apparently retired in the ring, and now he comes back and they get the Trios title. So hopefully this invigorates and energizes and puts a little bit of a fire under the Acclaimed that's been missing lately, but the Acclaimed and Billy Gunn getting the win over the House of Black. Good semi-main event match here. Again, nothing particularly wrong with it. There were a couple of rough spots, I think. There's a clothesline by Billy Gunn where he's supposed to do a clothesline of two House of Black members, and one had strayed a little too far out of his wingspan. So it looked a little rough. There were a couple other moments, but for the most part, it was good. And then we had MJF drawing Adam Cole when both pinned each other after a double clothesline. There were hints during the match of MJF, you know, he does the thumb to the eye, he does a couple other things. He, you know, Adam Cole, MJF doesn't want to pile drive Adam Cole on the table. Cole has no qualms about doing that. So they both kind of tease being more heelish. Cole wanted 5 more minutes after the match, and MJF basically agreed to restart the match until there was a finish. There were 2 ref bumps in the overtime period. Roddy Strong came out, kicked MJF low, gave Adam Cole the belt to use on Roddy Strong. Cole refused, and MJF ended up cradling Adam Cole for the victory. Cole seemed upset after the match. MJF tried to talk some positivity into him, and it worked. So it was all was good by the end of this. And, you know, sending the crowd home happy, I guess there's something to be said for that, right? Especially a crowd of this size where a lot of these people you're going to want to draw back again for next year's show. But, you know, I think there is, again, the part of the draw of this was who's going to turn on who, who's going to end up the heel, a real kind of blood feud type of thing. And that could still come, but I think people expected it here with this match. If you expected a turn and wanted one, I think you may have been disappointed. But still, the match was really good. The teases were really good. I think it was, and I know this is going to be sacrilegious to some people, but I think the storytelling of the match was on par with some of the Bloodline mid-match storytelling that we've become accustomed to with Roman Reigns and that story. So that is a positive. AEW appears to have some momentum now. There's going to be a lot of positive buzz about this show. Obviously, the positive buzz that comes from drawing 81,000 fans, even though their shows domestically have not been drawing as well, the advances have not been great. You're going to see what is the consequence of all of this positivity. Do they start to pick up in ticket sales elsewhere? Certainly we'll be keeping an eye on Double or Nothing ticket sales in Chicago, which have slowed, and you wonder if any momentum from this or the eventual announced matches for Double or Nothing during the week move tickets or move people to buy tickets for Double or Nothing. So just some things to be on the lookout for. Obviously ratings as well. You're going to have to see if those are increased maybe this week, knowing it's a week that's in between two pay-per-views. Are people going to tune in to want to see not only the fallout from this, but really the not just the last-minute push, but the push for All Out this week and see what matches are made? So we'll have to see. We've got a couple callers on hold, so there is room for you. 515-605-9345 is the number to call. Don't forget to press 1 on your keypad if you would like to talk. This is Wrestling Night in America for August 25th is next year that we'll be doing this, August 27th, 2023. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks. I tweeted throughout this show and love interacting with the fans there. Got a couple people who've replied to my question about what they thought of All In, and so I'll get to those a little later. WNIALivecast@gmail.com is where you can go if you can't call in for whatever reason and you're listening live and you want your thoughts to be broadcast on air. Send me an email and be happy to read it and talk a little bit about it as well. So let's go to the first call of the evening, and that distinction belongs to DJ from Miami at the 305 area code. DJ, welcome to Wrestling Night in America tonight. What did you think of All In?
It was pretty okay. I mean, there were the little things I was like, okay, but everything was pretty decent. I mean, everything was, you know, not too crazy blood like, you know, usually, but everything was pretty good. You know, so I give it, you know, a decent rating. Going into that, I don't know. Paige winning. Paige, mm-hmm. You know, Soraya, Paige, whatever. Her neck, you know, you have to treat her with, you know, kid hands. Why? I thought for sure it was going to be Baker, but I don't know. It's just like, at the end of the day, was she can't really be that great of fighting a champion like Britt Baker can or somebody else can, because, like I said, you have to treat her with kid gloves. I mean, at the end of the day, what do you think? She's definitely not going to be a long-term champion.
Well you know, a couple things, DJ, about that. The first is, you know, it's in England, so her family is there. It's a great moment for her in her career. You know, I don't think that's a bad thing to do, even if she is a short-term champion. It's going to give her and the fans a memory, a positive memory that will last forever. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Secondly, you know, you mentioned her neck. She's been cleared. She hasn't wrestled a ton, but I don't think, in terms of the matches, I don't think we've seen anything from her matches that strike me as saying, oh, they're doing that because they have to protect her neck, or they're doing that because, you know, she's been cleared for all contact. So I don't think she's really holding anything back. So from a bell-to-bell perspective, I don't really think there's a drawback of putting the title on Saraya. You can say that she hasn't lit the world on fire with her ring work since she's returned. Maybe you can make that argument, but that doesn't, not really sure that that has anything to do with the neck injury that she suffered and that, you know, forced her into retirement when she was with WWE. So I'm not really sure if there are limitations with her in the ring to the point that I wouldn't put the title on her. And the third thing is, you know, she's not going to be out there every week defending the title. You know, so I don't think that's a big concern either in terms of giving her too much of a workload knowing her past neck injuries. I think she'll wrestle the big shows, you know, Double or Nothing perhaps even, and maybe not. I mean, you have Chris Statlander who's going to defend the TBS title probably at Double or Nothing. So based on AEW's booking of the women, you could probably get away with not having Saraya defend the title at Double or Nothing. So given how little time AEW devotes to the women, you know, I don't think Saraya is going to be bogged down by the number of title defenses she's going to be asked to do. So, you know, when you talk about the neck injury and how that plays a part in her winning the title, I really don't think it's going to be a major factor.
Hope that, you know, something doesn't happen, you know, I'm scared that, you know, she's going to do this. I just hope that, you know, she's going to be a fighting champion
after
a while.
I mean, they're professionals, right? And AEW has a medical staff that's cleared her. Doctors have cleared her. She's wrestled for the last how long in AEW without having any major setbacks to our knowledge. And you would think that if there were setbacks and if there was any hesitancy, they wouldn't have put the title on her. So, you know, I hate to doubt AEW's decision-making just based on pure speculation.
Yeah, we'll see. But I just thought, let me ask one thing. I will say, I thought for sure it was going to be Britt Baker and they were going to put it on Adam Cole at the same time. That I do thought it was going to be for Sunny, for sure. I was like, oh, and then when they did that, I was like, oh, Adam's not going to win. My next thing, going into Adam thing, is that it's just so funny. It's just like, I guess that they did this thing so they can just keep on, you know, being like, I don't know why they wanted to be, you know, tag team champions. It just makes it more like, how many more, you know, kind of things can they do and make it more and more funny, you know? It's just like, it's getting a little old already, you know? And now they're champions, like, what can they really do at the end of the day, you know? Somebody at the end of the day wants that, not that tag team, they want that, you know, that heavyweight championship. So at the end of the day, I don't understand what they're going to really do. I mean, it's just going to, it's so weird. How they're going to pull this off. They're going to keep on. I mean, at the end of the day, of course, Adam's going to win it, but, I mean, when, where, I mean, how are they going to lose the tag team belt? This is so weird how they did this.
Yeah, let me bring on PWTorch.com contributor Brandon LeClaire, who writes the alternative perspective reports for these pay-per-views at PWTorch.com. Of course, editor Wade Keller writes a report as well. So, Brandon, thank you for joining me, and really appreciate you hopping on to give your analysis of the show with us.
Yeah, for sure. Glad to hop on and talk a little bit about it. I am just working through my analysis of the show in written form for PWTorch.com right now, and I'm happy to come on here and talk to you about it as well.
Well, maybe doing some audio will help organize those thoughts a little bit for your written work. So that's the hope. But you know, to DJ's question here, I think it's a legitimate question for those who are surprised that Cole and MJF are still best buddies after this. You know, they're still in the back of people's minds saying, okay, this has got to come to an end at some point. There's going to be a dastardly turn. It's going to be a big one. It's going to be a nasty one. When does it happen? How do they lose the ROH tag titles? Is that the impetus for the turn? You know, what happens as champions? Do they actually show up on ROH TV and defend the title? So, still, I mean, there's a lot of questions with this team staying together. How much of a surprise for you was it that they didn't break up here tonight?
It was a surprise to me, and I say that because so far, I haven't seen AEW be able to practice the level of restraint I think that is necessary for this to continue the way it has been. I think that I was certainly critical of MJF and All In being in this position early or in the early going. And I said, you know, the caveat was always, look, I'm enjoying the heck out of it. I think the segments on a week-to-week basis are incredibly fun. I love watching them. It's something I look forward to every week on TV. And at the same time, I think it's probably bad for business overall. Because I thought that you're going
funny
to
funny is
inadvertently...
money. Isn't that the phrase that they use?
Yeah, and it makes sense. I think that they were risking making MJF a babyface to a point that they couldn't come back from it. And I think you saw some of that tonight in the main event with Cole. Every time MJF would do anything dastardly, there was no question that the crowd was still firmly behind him 100%. And on the flip side, I thought that if MJF is going to turn on Cole and do, you know, the thing that we all expect him to do, then Cole is going to look like an idiot because this is who MJF is. This is what MJF does. And you don't want, for all intents and purposes, a guy who's become your top babyface in the main title picture in the summer. You don't want him looking stupid. And so I was afraid as to how they were going to get out of it. And I still don't know how they're going to get out of it. But with that being said, I assumed that that moment would happen today. I thought that the culmination would be today. And one way or another, being it MJF turning on Cole, Cole turning on MJF, I thought that the partnership would end today. And the fact that it didn't, I think, is a good thing because they've caught lightning in a bottle here. The crowd is evidently unbelievably into it. The crowd isn't looking for a turn. They want these two to be together. They want to cheer them both. And so I think they are right to continue to try to capitalize on it. And I think the way they went about it tonight worked.
I have so many questions for you, but I want to get back to DJ because he's on hold. So I will try to remember what I want to say after this. DJ, your third and final question for us tonight.
Yeah, going into my last question, I'm going to turn the page for a second then. I want to talk about what's going on in the other network, RIP Bray, you know what I'm saying? Going into this, now that this is kind of like crazy that this happened, but do you think at the end of the day, now this is over, like, do you think that there's going to be more magic, no magic? Do you think this is over with, you know, no more like Undertaker stuff or crazy magic stuff or black magic now that this is the end of the day? Because when you look at NXT, nobody does that stuff. Nobody's really gothic. Nobody's really has it, you know, like they did, you know. So I don't know. Is the magic over?
It's hard to say because that kind of thing ebbs and flows in professional wrestling historically. I would say that Bray Wyatt was a uniquely creative individual. You know, regardless of where you stood on what actually made it to television. And I think most people can agree that there was some really cool stuff that Bray Wyatt did as a character on television. And there was some stuff that just didn't work and were big misses. And you know, your percentage of both of those is going to vary, obviously. But it was largely, from my understanding, the brainchild, and much of it was motivated by Bray Wyatt's interest in that. And you know, if you don't have, you know, someone could come along, a high up wrestler, and say, I want to do this. I'm really interested in this kind of take on professional wrestling. And if you get someone high enough up in WWE, they may agree to it. You know, Triple H is the one who brought Bray Wyatt back after Vince McMahon fired him. So that tells you that in certain situations, at least, Triple H is not necessarily going to poo-poo that type of professional wrestling with the magic and the sorcery and things like that. Not dismiss it out of hand anyway. That being said, I think it would take someone who's very committed and some very outside the box thinking from a wrestler or people in creative Brandon to really stump for that sort of stuff, since it really is outside the box. And it's hard to, when you're in the grind of creating stories in professional wrestling and advancing stories on a week-to-week basis with no break, it's very hard to come up with things like that as a long-term story. So I would say that I'm not going to say we'll never see it again, but I would say there are certain conditions would have to be met for us to see someone like Bray Wyatt with that type of character reappear in WWE again.
Yeah, I mean, wrestling is everything, right? And everything is wrestling. So you can fit virtually anything you want to in pro wrestling if you try hard enough and if you can make the fans believe in it. So in that retrospect, in that sense, I don't think that the idea of a magical character in pro wrestling will ever really die. I think that as long as there is a promotion willing to present it and there are talent who are looking to explore that side of their creativity and that side of pro wrestling, that there's always going to be room for it. I think that it's gotten harder to present a character like that because of the shift in what fans want out of pro wrestling. I think we have moved closer toward the highbrow simulated sport in the sense that there's a large contingency of fans who don't want to see that kind of stuff. They want to see stellar athlete performing death-defying feats in a highbrow simulated combat style presentation. And a magical character like Bray Wyatt or like The Undertaker is very hard to fit within the confines of that style and that presentation of wrestling. But with a company like WWE, there's always going to be room for characters that don't fit the normal mold or what you would normally expect. And then there's companies like Impact where, you know, there's a lot more creative freedom. And when I was on the SmackDown post show with Wade Keller on Friday discussing, you know, the tribute to Bray Wyatt and also to Terry Funk, Javier Machado had joined us on the show, and he was talking about how he would have really enjoyed seeing Bray in Impact at some point just because he thought that it could be a true full realization of the Fiend character or something similar, obviously, for copyright concerns. And I agree. I think that you have to strike a certain balance in the promotion that you're in order for it to work. So I'm with you, Greg. I don't think that it's dead. I think we'll probably see it again at some point in some shape or form. But I do think that those opportunities will be more few and far between, and it will take a really special character to pull it off.
Mm-hmm. Hey, DJ, thank you for the phone call this week.
Can I ask you one more thing real quick? Oh, sorry about this. Do you think Bliss will come back or she'll retire, or do you think she can take the wand and pass it to her and she can do it because she's been doing it before with him?
I think she returns. I'm not 100% sold on that the more I think about it now. You know, obviously she's out right now. She's pregnant and, you know, that, there are some people who can come back real quick from that and juggle, and there's some people who just want to focus on being a mom. And so either choice she makes, you know, there's no wrong choice there. But I think she comes back, whether or not, Brandon, she comes back doing something Fiend level, I'm not so sure. She's been gone long enough to where she can come back as a completely different character, and it doesn't have to be anything Wyatt related. or anything like that. What's your take on Alexa Bliss and the potential for her not only to come back, but also to come back, you know, and I think there is, you know, there is a case to be made, I guess, if you want to continue that sort of storytelling, the Bray Wyatt kind of storytelling, you can do that with Alexa Bliss. I'm not sure what the appetite is going to be for that, because I think people would see that as sort of a, maybe a second rate and maybe not necessarily spitting at the memory of Bray Wyatt. I think that's a little too strong, but like, I mean, you know, there are people who I don't think would like to see that continued without Wyatt at the helm of it. So, you know, just your overall take on Alexa and her situation.
Yeah, I'd prefer that she didn't come back with that gimmick. And the reason for that is simply because whenever she was doing that, it always felt like it was a gateway to introduce something new or something more to the world of Bray Wyatt. It never felt like she alone was the character. It felt like she was committing actions or was being controlled by a higher power that was conceivably The Fiend or Bray Wyatt. And so I was always looking forward to the next reveal within the Bray Wyatt universe. I wasn't so invested in the Alexa Bliss character herself. And I think you saw that when Bray was not employed by the company and Bliss was still running with that character, it did feel really derivative. And they got too heavily invested in the doll and all of that, and it didn't click. It just didn't work. And it's one of the only times in Alexa Bliss's stint on the main roster where I felt like she couldn't keep up acting-wise. And that's a big thing to say, because genuinely, I think Bliss is one of the most natural actors that that company has. And so I would much rather see her just do a new character altogether or some spin-off of what we've seen her do previously. And you know, to wrap up on the Bliss topic, I think certainly it's totally up to her whether she wants to return after having her first child, or if she would much rather, you know, be with her husband and be with her baby. But I always am an advocate of Bliss being in the company. Like I said, I think her acting is far beyond that of the vast majority of the roster. I think she's a good representative of the company. I just think she has a lot to bring to the table for them overall.
All right, DJ, thank you for the phone call. Appreciate you calling in tonight.
Thanks.
All right, the phone lines are open, 515-605-9345. If you'd like to get on the call and talk AEW All In, please do so. You can press 1 to chat with Brandon and I. Brandon, I want to go back to the main event of All In and ask you this. Is there a way for MJF and Adam Cole to just stay babyface? And is it possible that neither of them turn on each other? Like, is that, you know, we're all conditioned because we've been watching wrestling for so long and we know every beat of every storyline, like they all repeat. But is it possible that they just are babyfaces in perpetuity?
I mean, I think so, at least right now, at least until the crowd loses interest or is really clamoring for one over the other. I think that this story has really become AEW's answer to the Bloodline. And obviously it's on a far less grandiose scale at this point, where we're several years into the Bloodline arc. But AEW has not had this long-running, intricate story for quite some time. And when I say that, what I'm referring to is a story that transcends well beyond the action in the ring. It's much more than this guy really dislikes this guy and they're facing each other. It becomes about friendship and what goes on outside of the ring and the way that these two wrestlers are making each other better wrestlers, better people, how their other friends are now becoming involved in the story, and why it makes sense that they're becoming involved, even if, you know, Roddy has been a bit annoying in his pursuit. It makes a lot of sense that he'd be doing what he's doing. So I think this has been the answer to the bloodline in a lot of ways. And if they feel like it's got legs to continue for a long period of time and the crowd continues to stick with it the way that they've stuck with the bloodline, then I don't see a need to turn them right now. I mean, short of feeling like Adam Cole has earned the right to be AEW champion, I don't think there's any reason to end this story right now. And by that, I mean, Adam Cole's not going to have the championship, which is unfortunate because I think Cole has put himself in a place where he deserves to hold that title at some point, and I still expect that he will. But he's still going to be in the main event. He's still going to be in the focal point of the company. He's still going to be at the top of these shows where I think he belongs. So I'm all for them just rolling with it.
I think MJF is a character that is layered in a way that you could do a long-term storyline like this. And then I made the comparison to the Bloodline earlier in the show as well. And I'm not saying MJF and Cole need to have this will they or won't they for 3 years.
Sure.
At some point they get on the page, stay on the same page, and that's it. I compare it a little bit to Adam Page and the Dark Order, where they might not have always been on screen together, but you knew they were tight, and if one of them was in trouble, the other one would come and make the save, and occasionally they'd team with each other. And that's kind of how I would see the Cole-MJF relationship developing if they were to stay together.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say the one difference that I think you're spot on in the comparison, but the one difference I would point out is just that Cole's involvement with the Dark Order, to me, always pulled Paige's involvement with the Dark Order, to me, always pulled Hangman down, whereas this, I think, is elevating both MJF and Cole.
And I think the whole idea of the Paige character was that he was complicated, in the same way that MJF is had those kind of trust issues. That was the same thing we had with Adam Page, right? So I do think that comparison is apt, and I'm interested to see where this goes. We've got a short turnaround to Double or Nothing next weekend. There's been no announcement of an AEW title match. We have CM Punk, who retained the Real World's Championship in the main event. Speaking of CM Punk, I'll break in with this. Tony Khan, who is doing the presser as we speak, did confirm that there was an altercation before the show, although he refused to give any details, said it was under investigation. So, a lot can change in a week's time with this situation. But CM Punk, World Champion. Adam Cole, still, there was enough pomp and circumstance in the middle of that match for Adam Cole to have a reasonable argument for a rematch. And then there's, third parties, whatever the case may be. So, what do you then see as the main event of Double or Nothing next weekend? Is it Punk versus MJF? Is it Cole versus MJF? Is it none of the above?
Well, Punk versus MJF feels like a bigger match than a one-week build to me. And I know that, it's kind of there. And
it's
waiting in the wings. Yeah, that's the thing. It's in Chicago. My preference for this is that all out doesn't happen because I think it's completely unnecessary, and they're oversaturating the market. They're asking too much out of their audience, and I think that it hurt the build for All In, and it obviously is going to hurt the build for All Out. But that's not my choice. So. All Out is going to happen, and they are going to need a main event that they will not have any opportunity to build. And Punk and MJF makes the most sense. The reason I struggle so much with the idea of doing Cole and MJF again right out of the gate is that it feels like it puts them in another will they or won't they situation. And I'd almost like to see them get away from that for a bit and just have them be focused on, the fact that they're friends and they're happy for each other. So I think Punk and MJF makes a little bit more sense right now. But you could also, if you were if they weren't worried about the reaction to not having a title defense in Chicago, I would not mind seeing MJF and Adam Cole teaming against CM Punk and another partner in the main event for the ROH titles. And that goes against what I'd normally recommend, because I think that you want to typically deliver a big title match for your pay-per-views. And two, I don't like the Ring of Honor titles being involved in main roster AEW yeah. television. But that's where we are, and I think it might be a better alternative.
Yeah, I think it forces people to ask the question, okay, what's the difference between the ROH tag titles and the AEW tag titles? And I don't think that's a question you want your fans asking. Like, it's one thing if you own two companies, they have two separate sets of titles, and they stay separate. You know, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Once you start defending them on, and this is the problem that a lot of people had with the ROH titles when they were on AEW television in the first place after Tony Khan bought ROH before
myself
he got,
included.
A distribution platform for it is, okay, you have all these titles that are basically duplications of titles that AEW already has. What am I, as the viewer, supposed to think is the difference other than the name? Like, you're defending them on the same show. There's not really a separate ROH company at that point. Now there is. But the ROH tag titles, how are they different than AEW tag titles if they're being defended on, across the same show? So, you know, I don't like that. I think that you're going to do something prominent with Punk because it is in Chicago. And whether that's a main event tag match or a main event situation, I don't know. Brandon, let me get your thoughts on All In as a whole. I know you said you're in the middle of writing your analysis piece for PWTorch.com. A lot of positivity coming out of this show. What did you think of it? If you have a 1-10 score, hit me up with it. Maybe not yet. Maybe you're still digesting it. But overall, your impressions of AEW running a show, 81,000 in Wembley Stadium.
Yeah, I don't know that I have a number grade for it yet. I always find those pretty challenging, but certainly a thumbs up show. I mean, without even a shred of doubt. I thought that this followed the mold of most AEW pay-per-views, and I say most because really, the only one that I could really take exception to would be this year's Double or Nothing, which I thought was much closer to a weak thumbs in the middle, bordering on a thumbs down show. But these AEW pay-per-views are more or less always strong to very strong thumbs up, and this was no exception. Now, that does not take away my criticism of everything that led up to this event, because aside from the Cole and MJF stuff, I don't think that this has been a good month of AEW television. I think they have been off the rails in a lot of ways since Blood and Guts. After Blood and Guts, I thought things kind of got a little sloppy again, and that has continued all the way up to this. I think that being the purported biggest show in wrestling history, there needed to be more built into this show. And I felt that way coming in, and my opinion on that was only strengthened when I saw the atmosphere today. As soon as I turned on the pre-show and saw the start of Zero Hour, I saw how incredibly impressive this setup was, how incredibly large the crowd was, how full Wembley looked. It looked monumental. It looked every bit as comparable in atmosphere to a WrestleMania. And that is a historic and a huge compliment and something that you can never take away from AEW. But I think they could have done better. I think they could have done a better job building this show up. So like I say, with most AEW pay-per-views, in a vacuum as a wrestling show, strong thumbs up, knocked it out of the park. Enjoyed the heck out of all 4 hours. As a, you know, total package, build and all, I'm a lot less enthusiastic about it. And that's usually how I feel with these shows.
Yeah, there are some shows where it's a lackluster build, and then the show itself just kind of blows you away to the point where you don't really even think about that after the show. And I think for a lot of people it's going to be the case here. I think the consensus seemed to be that AEW had not done a very good job of making All In feel special. And there were a lot of other things going on. You know, Tony Khan is being pulled in 25 different directions. I get that. But when you, as you said, when you saw the atmosphere and tuning into the pre-show and seeing the WrestleMania-like, as you mentioned, just kind of the impression that's left with you as a fan watching that is, wow, this is impressive. And then watching the show, having it be a strong thumbs up, I think to a certain extent, those concerns of mine about the build were alleviated a little bit. But I think the lesson is there that you don't want to, as a fan, you don't want to reward AEW and make them think that, okay, see, this, we don't have to do a strong build when the show is awesome because people will forget about it. So, I mean, you hesitate a little bit to point that out. And you know, I know they're having a Double or Nothing next weekend, so it's very hard to focus yourself. I think Tony Khan has trouble focusing himself a lot to begin with, and then you have like two shows back to back, two major shows the way AEW does, and I think it's very difficult. I want to go back to just the show and ask you about some high points. And again, for those of you who are just joining us, I think we have some people hopping on. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks, being joined by PWTorch.com contributor Brandon LeClaire. We're talking AEW All In here on Wrestling Night in America on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Would love for you to join the conversation. 515-605-9345 is the number to call. Press 1 if you'd like to talk. Otherwise, you can email us, WNIALivecast@gmail.com. Let's start with the first match, Punk versus Samoa Joe. What did you think of that match? I thought it was a good match. I thought it was the right match to start the show with.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was good. I thought it was an improvement over their last encounter on Collision, I think it was. It was a lot of fun. I mean, Punk took on more of the heel role in the match itself. I really appreciated like the historical callbacks that they were doing. I mean, some alluding back to their own history against each other, but then others were just callbacks to wrestlers of previous generations that had you know worked at Wembley or worked at you know comparable venues in London or not comparable but other venues in London. I thought it was neat. Punk had a nice little tribute to Terry Funk that I thought was good. I always appreciate Joe's, you know, stepping out of the way spot. I thought that was cool that Punk thwarted the first one only to be caught by it just moments later when he wasn't expecting Joe to immediately follow up on it. So good opener, good crowd. And I saw briefly on Twitter or X after this match. I didn't have a ton of time to scroll through, but I saw that people were thinking that this felt almost like a goodbye for Punk, and I don't know if they were reading into that because of the altercation that was revealed to have taken place just before. But I didn't get that sense at all watching it. It just felt to me more like Punk was emotional at the fact that you know it was such an unbelievable crowd and that he hadn't wrestled in England for what over a decade at this point.
Yeah, I did notice the camera seemed to stay on him a lot longer for the post-match than it did for a lot of others, so I don't know if people saw that and read into that maybe or what the deal was.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah. The sixth man, that was match number 2, Takeshita, Jay White, Juice Robinson over Kenny Omega, Ibushi, and Adam Page. I kind of made the argument earlier that I wish this was split up into singles matches, but then again, you'll probably do Omega versus Takeshita at Double or Nothing. Is that kind of how you see things turning out?
Yeah, I assume Kenny and Takeshita will wrestle at All Out, which are All Out. I get the two confused, and them being a week apart makes it even harder.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume that the two will wrestle it All Out, and I think that makes sense. I'm a little let down at the fact that Kenny Omega was kind of relegated to a six person match on this you know massive show. But I thought that he worked well. Everybody meshed well together. I think it was a positive that you continued to showcase Takeshita and put him in a big position there to get a win over Kenny. And I also just noted so far in my analysis for PWTorch.com that I'm glad that Kenny Omega has remained focused and serious. I like Kenny Omega so much more when he's not being sprayed down by Brandon Cutler and he's not, you know, dancing with the Bucks and, you know, having Callis at his side. Obviously, that's a little different now. But when Callis was at his side, I just liked that pairing. I'm just glad to see Kenny in a more serious and focused role. So,
Young Bucks versus FTR, follow that up. Did this match your expectations? Because I know that this is a match that people have been clamoring for years. We've gotten two versions of them. Some people have been a little disappointed by what we've seen so far from these two. How did this match meet your expectations, you know, especially considering the age of the competitors compared to, like, when people were first fantasy booking them together and just the wear and tear on them in that time since?
I really liked it. I don't know that it was necessarily my favorite of the trilogy that they've had. I also want to acknowledge that I was actually in attendance for the second one. They did that match in Boston, and I was there, and it was certainly a highlight of that taping. A really, really, really great match that had a great crowd. So, you know, it's hard to top that one for me personally, but I thought this was a really good match. Strong outing for all four guys. Despite, you know, sort of something I'd echo about the show as a whole, the build has left a lot to be desired for me. I like the finishing sequence a lot in particular. I liked, you know, I'm not usually a big advocate for kicking out of finishers, but I like that they went with the Shatter Machine kick out followed by the BTE trigger kick out to give, you know, each team one-to-one. And I thought it made sense in the regard that these two teams know each other so well, and that's the story that they've been trying to tell, that it would make sense that if anybody was going to kick out of their finishers, it would be the other team. So I didn't mind it there, and I also liked the moment at the end of the match with Dax, where he broke up a pin only to stand up and realize that the Bucks were waiting for him. And it's almost like because he and Cash threw the trigger at the Bucks, he knew that they were going to give him the Shatter Machine, and he walked right into it. I thought it was cool. I thought they did some solid storytelling, and it worked for me. I also like the fact that it feels like the Bucks are headed to a more heel direction. I think they are better suited as heels. I think that a lot of times they come off as quite unlikable, particularly in this build-up with FTR. I thought they were very unlikable in those promos with them. So I think it's a good move.
Stadium Stampede was next. The one thing I said about this match when I was running down the card at the beginning was, as long as these type of matches, you can say that they were wild, people tend to like them. And this one was wild. I mean, it was not the Stadium Stampede traditionally that we've come to know, but it was wild. What were your impressions of this match?
Yeah, this is never going to be my favorite kind of match, but I can appreciate it for what it is. And I enjoy seeing Jon Moxley come up with creative ways to be brutal and violent. And I mean, it has gotten to a bit of a point to parody the bleeding from Mox. I mean, in this match in particular, I believe he bled before he was ever even shown on camera once the bell had rang. So by the time I wrote Moxley's name for the first time within the confines of the match for my report, he was already bleeding from his eye. So, I mean, that's just what you come to expect from Mox. I you know, you can take it or leave it. I would prefer that it happened a little bit less, but I don't think that that's what he wants to do. So I don't think I'll ever become desensitized to screwdrivers and forks, and that's a good thing. They're still as violent and brutal to me as they were the first time they were introduced. I do wish they were, you know, used a little bit more sparingly. The skewer spot to me was the highlight, low light, whatever you want to refer to it as here, but that was bloody and violent and gross, and it walked the line of what I think I find acceptable in one of these matches. Of course, Moxley is going to take a handful of skewers to the skull and then eat a DDT on top of them. I mean, like, it just, mm-hmm. you know, just wild. Exactly like you said, it was wild. My one issue with this match, I just don't think that the Blackpool Combat Club should be taking a fall in this style of match to the Best Friends. And I get that there's a lot of equity in Orange Cassidy. I see it. I agree with it. I think he brings a lot to the table, and I understand why he is as pushed as he is. But Trent Beretta and Chuck Taylor don't belong going toe-to-toe with the BCC. They just don't. And I just don't think a hodgepodge, random group of wrestlers should be able to beat this violent, brutal force. I think it was the wrong move. I know that they wanted to have a lot of matches on this show that send the crowd home happy, but Blackpool Combat Club is already kind of reeling from losing Blood and Guts, and I just think that losing this style of violent match should be so rare for that group, because it's what they are. It's what they love. It's what they crave and what they want, and if they can't win those matches, then what good are they?
Yeah. And who knows? There are some people who argue that the BCC has run their course, and maybe this would be the, you know, kind of what leads to them going their separate ways.
The next match was
the women's match, Saraya winning the women's title. DJ, in his first point, I'm not sure if you heard, talked about Saraya and concerns he has around Saraya with her neck. Being AEW champion, being able to carry that ball for AEW. Are there any concerns for you with Saraya having the title and, you know, having already once been medically retired?
No concerns off the bat, just because I assume that she has done the due diligence, that she has conferenced with the right people, that she has been cleared by the right doctors, and that they are confident in her ability to do this and continue to do it at a high level. I mean, we have seen at this point multiple people return from this injury. We have Bryan Danielson, we have Edge. Both have done so successfully, and Saraya has done so successfully to date. I think that those questions were natural early on of both Edge and Bryan Danielson. I think they subsided over time, and I would expect that the same will occur with Saraya. She hasn't wrestled a ton since coming back, and since being in AEW, she's been more of a talking piece than a managerial role, so I understand why the concern would still be there, but I do think that that they're probably, you know, I have to trust that the doctors have her best interest in mind, and she's fine.
Sting and Darby Allin defeated Swerve and Christian in a coffin match. Darby Allin, as expected, throwing himself around the ring, taking a beating, and Sting kind of doing the same. The feud of the year might be Sting versus tables, because we saw another situation where Sting failed to break a table, and you can kind of see him like climb himself back in the ring, like, okay, let's try it again, you know,
yeah.
Go through it again. But any thoughts on this match? We saw Nick Wayne get involved. You know, sort of an unfortunate situation where they had to, seems like, write things out on the fly with A.R. Fox being kicked out of Mogul Embassy for whatever reason. It seems like he wasn't able to travel with them to the UK for this show. He was originally supposed to team with Swerve against Sting and Darby Allin. So I just thought that was a little bit of a downer of this, as good as Christian is, and as much as his involvement in here does sort of make sense. I really like A.R. Fox, and I would have really liked to have seen the continuation of that storyline with him.
Yeah, just poor planning. I mean, you know, having to write A.R. Fox out, they had to write Rey Fénix out. Was Rey Fénix's removal also, was that also due to visa issues, or was that an injury thing?
I don't think it was an injury, because that's what I thought at first, and then he wrestled that full match, was it on Rampage that he wrestled it?
Yeah.
And I'm like,
he wouldn't be wrestling like this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I was like, there can't be an injury if he's going this full bore in a match like this.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff. It's the kind of oversight that you just don't like to see in a company that is now this successful with this much money and this many people working in so many areas. There should have been checks and balances for this. It's just poor oversight, and it's a bummer because the AR Fox stuff just put a damper on this whole angle for sure. I mean, having Darby Allin just welcome him back, it made Darby look stupid. It just wasn't good. As far as the match itself, I thought it was a Sting and Darby Allin match. I mean, you pretty much know what you're getting from these two. Darby's going to basically kill himself. Sting is going to take some probably ill-advised bumps, get his signature moves in, and they're going to win. Every time, they're going to win. I'm of two minds here because on one hand, I'm a huge proponent of Swerve Strickland. I think that he deserves a significant push in AEW. And so I was glad to see that he was getting a big match on a very big stage against very popular opponents. But on the flip side, you know he's going to lose. And that's exactly what he did. And he's the one that got tossed in the coffin. So, you know, I mean... enjoyable 15 minutes or whatever of the same stuff from Darby and Sting. It's just not for me.
Ospreay versus Jericho. This was a match that I think people were looking forward to see what Jericho truly had left in the tank and to see whether he could really keep up with Ospreay. I think he did for the most part. How did this match go for you? Did you see it as Jericho keeping up with Ospreay, Ospreay kind of pacing himself down a little bit to be more accessible to Jericho, or was it a meeting in the middle a little bit?
Felt like they met in the middle. In the opening seconds of the match, Ospreay was moving so quickly that it looked like Jericho was moving in slow motion. And you got to see the disparity in athleticism between the two at this point. Ospreay definitely slowed himself down as things progressed. And I don't know if that was just him recognizing the disparity or if it was Jericho kind of calming him down and walking him through it. Not that Ospreay needs that at this point, just, you know, for the circumstances. I thought the match was good. It was about as good as you're going to get from Jericho at this point. Ospreay needed to, should have, and did win clean. I don't think that at this stage of the game you want Jericho beating somebody at the caliber of Will Ospreay. They did have the issue with crowd reaction, though. Ospreay clearly meant to be the heel, has Don Callis in his corner. Chris Jericho clearly meant to be the babyface, fresh off of leaving the Jericho Appreciation Society and getting turned on by Don Callis. And yet, Jericho's offense was getting booed. Crowd was clearly behind Ospreay. So, and that may not be an issue outside of London. You know, they can easily course correct that stuff. And it's not like Ospreay is around all the time. But I think the Jericho storyline has been too convoluted for people to really know where and how to latch on to him. So it's just not he's not in a great place right now, and I'm intrigued to see what they do. I mean, with him ditching Sammy Guevara at the end of the match, but it's just not he's definitely in the phase of winding down, and I just don't know how much more there is for him to do that is genuinely worth it. I do want to say though, of course he sung himself to the ring. Of course he did.
Hey, why not? Acclaimed and Billy Gunn over the House of Black Anything Goes match. I thought this was the perfect match to be the semi-main of this show. I still think they're trying to recapture the magic they once had with the Acclaimed. I'm not sure if putting the trios titles on them is going to be the same as putting the tag titles on them. But clearly there is cachet in having Billy Gunn with them. I never would have thought that, but clearly there's something there with the chemistry of that. and, you know, the story of the Acclaimed kind of almost losing their way with Billy not being with them and then having to go and sort of recruit him back. You kind of hope that's the trigger of them finding their way again and being the top act they can be again. I thought this was a decent match. You know, there were some rough spots in it, but, you know, I thought it was fine. And, you know, I think getting the trios titles off the House of Black and doing the weird matches where the opponents get to say what kind of matches it is probably a plus in the long run.
Yeah, fine match. I appreciated very much the Malakai tribute to Bray Wyatt at the beginning. I thought that was nice and classy and very fitting for the gimmick that they have. The Acclaim did what the Acclaim do, and for the most part, it works. I thought Billy Gunn was a little worse than usual in this one. He seemed a step slower and a step more sloppy, but he wasn't asked to do a whole lot, so it was for the most part fine. I continue to think the House of Black, in particular Malakai Black, deserve a lot more than what they've been given so far, and so losing to the Acclaim feels, you know, a little cruddy in that respect, but I agree in the general sense that the house rules stuff was kind of pokey. I don't think they need to do it, and I'd rather see them do bigger and better things. Unfortunately, this all does just kind of continue the narrative and the trend of these titles just not really meaning a whole lot, and that's not just the Trios Championship. That's a lot of titles. I mean, you can definitely say that about the FTW title, which really shouldn't even be a thing. You can say it about the TBS and TNT championships, which both seem virtually meaningless now. And you can certainly say it about the AEW Women's World title, which I thought was just further dragged through the mud tonight. We didn't really get into the meat and potatoes of that women's match, but I just think that division as a whole is in a whole lot of trouble. And so it's unfortunate because you bump these titles around. It's not like House of Black has had them for a particularly long time or have been given a chance to establish themselves as being particularly dominant in any major way. And then you move the titles off to somebody new. So I just don't care for it. I don't care for the hot potato of championships, and this just continues that trend.
You know, I do wonder, one of the things that I saw when the Young Bucks and Omega got away from the trios is now the Young Bucks can do major stuff in the tag division, Omega can do stuff in the singles division like he's going to do with Takeshita, and that's kind of my hope, that the House of Black losing the trios titles kind of is the springboard for Malakai Black to maybe be a more active competitor in the singles division. Even Buddy and Brody, I think, can make an impact in us, you know, going after a singles title, and, you know, they've been together as a trio for a long time to where it's going to be fresh when they break out as you mentioned, a tag team or Malakai in the singles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like the idea of Buddy and Brody going for FTR. I mean, I think that's a really good match that they've got, you know, waiting in the wings. I think Buddy and Brody work exceptionally well together. You don't need to break up the House of Black. Just let them do their thing while Malakai does his. And Julia Hart has been great with them, too. So, yeah, I mean, my vote is keep them together, let them do their own thing, and get them up the card because they're all supremely talented, and they're very over. I mean, the crowd obviously buys into their offense, particularly Malakai Black, who just looks like he is a killer out there. I want to see more of them.
And then anything else on the main event? I guess we didn't really talk about the body of the match and how it progressed and the teases of heel turns by both men. Were you okay with sort of how it developed with the double pin? I agree with a lot of people online who said that the calling of the double clothesline and then them hitting it was a little too hokey. And that's kind of the trouble of this, the whole funny doesn't equal money and things like that is, you know, it's for the title, but the build has been these comedy vignettes where they're kind of getting together as a duo. And so that's the difficult part of this is, you know, if you want to be serious as a singles and in main title matches of pay-per-views, that stuff is the stuff that you feel like you got to cut out. So what did you think of just how the match developed with that double pin, with a couple ref bumps, with Roddy Strong getting involved in all of that?
I thought they walked a really fine line, and I say that in the sense that you don't want your main event to devolve into just a comedic mess between these two, or like a bro fest between these two. There has to be some violence, there has to be some discontent, and there has to be some teases of one or both going too far. And I think that playing Adam Cole as the heel of the match, but not actually turning him, was key, because Cole is desperate to win the championship. Cole has never tasted the gold before. He wants that title, and he is willing to set aside his friendship, even temporarily, in order to do it. And he thinks that Max is so good, and that Max is so likely to dip into his bag of tricks, that he needs to be extra aggressive in order to do it. Meanwhile, on the flip side, MJF is the reigning champion. He's supremely confident in himself. He may have doubts about how good Adam Cole actually is, even if he's not letting it on to Cole. And so he is wrestling a more typical style of MJF match. He's not going to shy away from taking cheap shots or from, you know, poking him in the eye, from doing the things that MJF does. He's just going to do it in a slightly more jovial manner because the crowd is behind him. But he is going to second-guess himself when it comes to extra-violent or extraordinary steps to pin this guy. MJF wants to just beat Adam Cole in a wrestling match and not have to drive him into steps, put him through tables, the whole nine yards. And I thought that that was really, really smart. And they worked the closest thing that AEW has to a main event WWE-style match, in that there were a lot of bells and whistles, there was interference, there was ref bumps, there was a lot of talking, both with Adam Cole and MJF talking to each other, talking to themselves, talking to the crowd. There was a lot of that. It's the same stuff you see in Roman Reigns matches that has been so successful and has built up a lot of drama, and I thought that's what they did. They made a drama-filled, entertaining main event, even if it wasn't the style of main event that AEW is used to putting out. But to me, that was a net positive, because we got the high-paced, high-flying, fast-paced, violent wrestling all up and down this card. So the main event was a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. Agreed. Agreed on all those accounts, Brandon. Well said. I'm going to let you go. Get back to writing up your analysis piece. People can find it on pwtorch.com coming up within the next day or so, I'm sure. Thank you so much for hopping on and chatting with us, Brandon.
Yeah, of course. Super super fun, and definitely helped me flesh out some of my analysis on the latter portions of the show. I'm gonna get back to that, and it'll be my full report is already up, and the analysis is coming as I finish each match, so should be all done within the next half hour or so.
Awesome. Well, we'll look forward to reading it. PWTorch.com. Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks.
And thanks, everybody, for your participation tonight. Don't forget, we're going to have this show again next Saturday night after WWE Payback. So if you're a WWE fan, you're going to watch Payback, tune in after that show and call us up, 515-605-9345. This is much more fun when you participate. So please, I endorse calling up and sharing your thoughts on the show, or at the very least, emailing us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. We'll talk to you again next weekend. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter @GregMParks. And until next week, this has been Wrestling Night in America.